Look to Windward by Ian M. Banks. Narrated by Robert Lister. Prologue by Carolyn Oldershaw. This work is copyrighted 2000 by Ian M. Banks. This recording is copyrighted 2000 by W.F. Howes Limited. Gentile or Jew, O you who turn the wheel and look to windward, consider Phlebas, who was once handsome and tall as you. T.S. Eliot, The Wasteland, 4. For the Gulf War Veterans. The Chelgrian Civil War saw destruction on a galactic scale, so much so that one particular maneuver was responsible for exploding two suns and thereby losing billions of lives. Tragic as it was, it seems that the casualties of the war may soon be eclipsed. Disagreeing with the rigid caste system of his home world, the galactically famous composer, Chelgrian Zilla, has decided he would rather live on Massac. When Quill, an emissary of Chell, still haunted by the past, comes to speak to him, Zilla and everyone else assume he'll be asked to return home. However, the Chelgrians have other ideas. Quill's mission is so top secret, even he doesn't yet know what it is, or where it will take him. The only certainty is that it will be somewhere he'd really rather not go. And now, look to windward.
Prologue. Near the time we both knew I would have to leave him, it was hard to tell which flashes were lightning and which came from the energy weapons of the invisibles. A vast burst of blue-white light leapt across the sky, making an inverted landscape of the ragged cloud's undersurface, and revealing through the rain the destruction all around us, the shell of a distant building, its interior scooped out by some earlier cataclysm, the tangled remains of rail pylons near the crater's lip, the fractured service pipes and tunnels the crater had exposed, and the massive, ruined body of the wrecked land destroyer lying half-submerged in the pool of filthy water in the bottom of the hole. When the flare died, it left only a memory in the eye, and the dull flickering of the fire inside the destroyer's body. Quillan gripped my hand still tighter. "You should go. Now, Warasai." Another smaller flash lit his face and the oil-scummed mud around his waist, where it disappeared under the war machine. I made a show of consulting my helm's readout. The ship's flyer was on its way back, alone. The display told me that no larger craft was accompanying it, while the lack of any communication on the open channel meant there was no good news to report. There would be no heavy lift. There would be no rescue. I flipped to the close-quarter tactical view. Nothing better to report there. The confused, pulsing schematics indicated there was great uncertainty in the representation, a bad enough sign in itself, but it looked like we were right in the line of the invisible's advance, and we would soon be overrun. In 10 minutes, maybe. Or 15. Or 5. That uncertain. Still, I smiled as best I could and tried to sound calm. "I can't get to anywhere safer until the flyer gets here," I said quietly. "Neither of us can." I shifted on the muddy slope, trying to find a better footing. A series of booms shook the air. I crouched over Quillan, protecting his exposed head. I heard debris thudding onto the slope across from us, and something splashed into the water. I glanced at the level of the pool in the bottom of the crater, as the waves slapped against the chisel shape of the land destroyer's fore-armor, and fell back again. At least the water didn't seem to be rising any more. "Warasai," he said, "I don't think I'm going anywhere. Not with this thing on top of me. Please, I'm not trying to be heroic, and neither should you. Just get out now. Go!" "There's still time," I told him. "We'll get you out of there. You were always so impatient." Light pulsed above us again, picking out each lancing drop of rain in the darkness. "And you were..." Whatever he was going to say was drowned out by another fusillade of sharp concussions. The noise rolled over us, as though the very air was being torn apart. "Loud night," I said, as I crouched over him again. My ears were ringing. More light flickered to one side, and close up, I could see the pain in his eyes. "Even the weather's against us, Quillen. Dreadful thunder." "That was not thunder." "Oh, it was. There, and that is lightning," I said, as I crouched further over him. "Go. Now, Warasai," he whispered. "You're being stupid." I began. Then my rifle slipped from my shoulder, and the stock hit him on the forehead. "Ouch," he said. "Sorry." I shouldered the weapon again. "My fault for losing my helmet." "Still," I slapped one of the sections of track above us. "You gained a land destroyer." He started to laugh, then winced. He forced a smile and rested one hand against the surface of one of the vehicle's guide wheels. "It's funny," he said. "I'm not even sure if it's one of ours or one of theirs." "You know," I said, "neither am I." I looked up at its ruptured carcass. The fire inside seemed to be spreading. Thin blue and yellow flames were starting to show in the hole where the main turret had been. The crippled land destroyer had kept its tracks on this side as it had half trundled, half slid into the crater. On the far side, the stripped track lay flat on the crater's slope, a stride-wide strip of flat metal sections leading up like a ramshackle escalator, almost to the hole's jagged lip. In front of us, huge guide wheels protruded from the war machine's hull. Some supported the giant hinges of the track's upper course. Others ran on the tracks beneath. Quillen was trapped beneath their lower level, squashed into the mud, with only his upper torso free. Our comrades were dead. There were only Quillen and me, and the pilot of the light flyer returning to pick us up. The ship, just a couple of hundred kilometers above our heads, could not help. I had tried pulling Quillen, ignoring his bitten-off moans, but he was held fast. I had burned out my suit's AG unit, trying to shift the track sections trapping him, and cursed our supposedly wonderful nth-generation projectile weapons, so good for killing our own species and penetrating armor, so useless for cutting through thick metal. Noise crackled nearby. Sparks flicked out of the fire in the turret aperture, rising and fading in the rain. I could feel the detonations through the ground, transmitted by the body of the wrecked machine. "Ammunition going off," Quillen said, his voice strained. "Time you went." "No. I think whatever blew the turret off accounted for all the ammunition." "And I don't. It could still blow up. Get out!" "No. I'm comfortable here." "You're what?" "I'm comfortable here." Now you're being idiotic. I'm not being idiotic. Stop trying to get rid of me. Why should I? You're being idiotic. Stop calling me idiotic, will you? You're bickering. I am not bickering. I'm trying to get you to behave rationally. I am behaving rationally. This doesn't impress me, you know. It's your duty to save yourself. And yours not to despair. Not despair. My comrade and mate is acting like an imbecile, and I've got a... Quillan's eyes widened. Up there, he hissed, pointing behind me. What? I twisted, bringing my rifle round, and then going still. The invisible trooper was at the crater lip, peering down at the wreckage of the land destroyer. He had some sort of helmet on, but it didn't cover his eyes and probably wasn't very sophisticated. I gazed up through the rain. He was lit by firelight from the burning land destroyer. We ought to be mostly in shadow. The trooper's rifle was held in one hand, not both. I stayed very still. Then he brought something up to his eyes, scanning. He stopped, looking straight at us. I had raised the rifle and fired by the time he had let the night sight drop and begun to bring his weapon to bear. He exploded in light, just as another flash erupted in the skies above. Most of his body tumbled and slipped down the slope towards us, shorn of one arm and his head. "Suddenly you're a half-decent shot," Quillan said. "I always was, dear," I told him, patting his shoulder. "I just kept it quiet because I didn't want to embarrass you." "Warasai," he said, taking my hand again. "That one will not have been alone. Now really is the time to go." I began. Then the hulk of the land destroyer and the crater around us shook as something exploded inside the wreck and glowing shrapnel whizzed out of the space where the turret had been. Quillan gasped with pain. Mudslides coasted down around us, and the remains of the dead invisible slid another few strides closer. His gun was still clutched in one armored glove. I glanced at my helm screen again. The flyer was almost here. My love was right, and it really was time to go. I turned back to say something to him. "Just fetch me that bastard's rifle," he said, nodding at the dead trooper. "See if I can't take another one or two of them with me." "All right," I said, and found myself scrambling up the mud and debris and grabbing the dead soldier's rifle. "And see if he has anything else," Quillan shouted. "Grenades! Anything!" I slid back down, overshooting, and getting both boots in the water. "All he had," I said, handing him the rifle. He checked it as best he could. "That'll do." He fitted the stock against his shoulder and twisted round as far as his trapped lower body would allow, settling into something approaching a firing position. "Now go, before I shoot you myself." He had to raise his voice over the sound of more explosions, tearing at the wreck of the land destroyer. I fell forward and kissed him. "I'll see you in heaven," I said. His face took on a look of tenderness, just for a moment, and he said something, but explosions shook the ground, and I had to ask him to repeat what he'd said, as the echoes died away and more lights strobed in the skies above us. A signal blinked urgently in my visor to tell me the flyer was immediately overhead. "I said there's no rush," he told me quietly, and smiled. "Just live, Warasai. Live for me." For both of us. Promise? I promise. He nodded up the slope of the crater. Good luck, Warasai. I meant to say good luck in return, or just goodbye, but I found I could not say a thing. I just gazed hopelessly at him, looking upon my husband for that one last time, and then I turned and hauled myself upwards, slithering on the mud, but pulling myself away from him, past the body of the invisible I had killed, along the side of the burning machine's hull, and traversing its rear beneath the barrels of its aft turret, while more explosions sent flaming wreckage soaring into the rain-filled sky and splashing into the rising waters. The sides of the crater were slick with mud and oils. I seemed to slip down more than I was able to climb up, and for a few moments I believed I would never make my way out of that awful pit, until I slid and hauled myself over to the broad metal ribbon that was the stripped track of the land destroyer. What would kill my love saved me. I used the link sections of the embedded track as a staircase, at the end almost running to the top. Beyond the lip, in the flame-lit distances between the ruined buildings and the squalls of rain, I could see the lumbering shapes of other great war machines, and the tiny scurrying figures behind them all moving this way. The flyer swooped from the clouds. I threw myself aboard, and we lifted immediately. I tried to turn and look back, but the door slammed closed, and I was thrown about the cramped interior, while the tiny craft dodged rays and missiles aimed at it as it rose to the waiting ship. Winter Storm.
Chapter 1. The Light of Ancient Mistakes. The barges lay on the darkness of the still canal, their lines softened by the snow heaped in pillows and hummocks on their decks. The horizontal surfaces of the canal's paths, piers, bollards and lifting bridges bore the same full-billowed weight of snow, and the tall buildings set back from the quaysides loomed over all, their windows, balconies and gutters, each a line edged with white. It was a quiet area of the city at almost any time, Carbet knew, but tonight it both seemed and was quieter still. He could hear his own footsteps as they sank into the untouched whiteness. Each step made a creaking noise. He stopped and lifted his head, sniffing at the air. Very still. He had never known the city so silent. The snow made it seem hushed, he supposed, muffling what little sound there was. Also tonight there was no appreciable wind at ground level, which meant that, in the absence of any traffic, the canal, though still free of ice, was perfectly still and soundless, with no slap of wave or gurgling surge. There were no lights nearby positioned to reflect from the canal's black surface, so that it seemed like nothing, like an absolute absence on which the barges appeared to be floating unsupported. That was unusual, too. The lights were out across the whole city, across almost all this side of the world. He looked up. The snow was easing now. Spinwards, over the city centre and the still more distant mountains, the clouds were parting, revealing a few of the brighter stars as the weather system cleared. A thin, dimly glowing line directly above, coming and going as the clouds moved slowly overhead, was far side light. No aircraft or ships that he could see. Even the birds of the air seemed to have stayed in their roosts. And no music. Usually in a Keem city you could hear music coming from somewhere or other, if you listened hard enough, and he was good at listening hard.
but this evening he couldn't hear any. Subdued. That was the word. The place was subdued. This was a special, rather somber night. Tonight you dance by the light of ancient mistakes, Zilla had said in an interview that morning, with only a little too much relish. And the mood seemed to have infected all of the city, the whole of Zarav Plate, indeed the entire orbital of Masak. And yet even so, there seemed to be an extra stillness caused by the snow. Kabe stood for a moment longer, wondering exactly what might cause that additional hush. It was something that he had noticed before, but never quite been bothered enough about to try and pin down. Something to do with the snow itself. He looked back at his tracks in the snow covering the canal path. 3 lines of footprints. He wondered what a human, what any bipedal, would make of such a trail. Probably, he suspected, they would not notice. Even if they did, they would just ask, and instantly be told. Hub would tell them. Those will be the tracks of our honored Homomdan guest, Ambassador Kabe Ishluye. Ah, so little mystery these days. Kabe looked around, then quickly did a little hopping, shuffling dance, executing the steps with a delicacy belying his bulk and weight. He glanced about again, and was glad to have apparently escaped observation. He studied the pattern his dance had left in the snow. That was better. But what had he been thinking of? The snow, and its silence. Yes, that was it. It produced what seemed like a subtraction of noise, because one was used to sound accompanying weather. Wind sighed or roared, rain drummed or hissed, or if it was mist and too light to produce noise directly, at least created drips and glugs. But snow, falling with no wind to accompany it, seemed to defy nature. It was like watching a screen with the sound off. It was like being deaf. That was it. Satisfied, Kabe tramped on down the path, just as a whole sloped roof load of snow fell with a muffled but distinct crump from a tall building onto ground nearby. He stopped, looked at the long ridge of whiteness that the miniature avalanche had produced as the last few flakes fell swirling round it, and laughed, quietly, so as not to disturb the silence. At last, some lights. From a big barge 4 vessels away round the canal's gradual curve, and the hint of some music, too, from the same source. Gentle, undemanding music, but music nevertheless. Fill-in music, biding music, as they sometimes called it, not the recital itself. A recital. Kabe wondered why he had been invited. The contact drone E.H. Tersono had requested Kabe's presence there in a message delivered that afternoon. It had been written in ink, on card, and delivered by a small drone. Well, a flying salver, really. The thing was, Kabe usually went to Tersono's 8th-day recital anyway. Making a point of inviting him to it had to mean something. Was he being told that he was being in some way presumptuous, having come along on earlier occasions when he hadn't been specifically invited? That would seem strange. In theory, the event was open to all. What was not in theory? But the ways of culture people, especially drones, and most especially old drones like E.H. Tersono, could still surprise Kabe. No laws or written regulations at all, but so many little observances, sets of manners, ways of behaving politely, and fashions. They had fashions in so many things, from the most trivial to the most momentous. Trivial. That paper message delivered on a salver, Did that mean that everybody was going to start physically moving invitations and even day-to-day information from place to place, rather than have such things transmitted normally, communicated to one's house, familiar, drone, terminal or implant? What a preposterous and deeply tedious idea. And yet, just the sort of retrospective affectation they might fall in love with for a season or so. At most. Momentous, they lived or died by whim. A few of their more famous people announced they would live once and die forever, and billions did likewise. Then a new trend would start amongst opinion formers, for people to back up and have their bodies wholly renewed or new ones regrown, or to have their personalities transferred into android replicas, or some other more bizarre design, or, well, anything. There was really no limit. But the point was that people would start doing that sort of thing by the billion too, just because it had become fashionable. Was that the sort of behaviour one ought to expect from a mature society? Mortality as a lifestyle choice? Kabe knew the answer his own people would give. It was madness, childishness, disrespectful of oneself and life itself, a kind of heresy. He, however, was not quite so sure, which either meant that he had been here too long, or that he was merely displaying the shockingly promiscuous empathy towards the culture that had helped bring him here in the first place. So, musing about silence, ceremony, fashion, and his own place in society, Kabe arrived at the ornately carved gangway that led from the quayside into the gently lit extravagance in gilded wood that was the ancient ceremonial barge, Soliton. The snow here had been tramped down by many feet, the trail leading to a nearby subtrans access building. Obviously, he was odd, enjoying walking in the snow. But then he didn't live in this mountain city. His own home here hardly ever experienced snow or ice, so it was a novelty for him. Just before he went aboard, the Hommomdan looked up into the night sky to watch a V-shaped flock of big, pure white birds fly silently overhead, just above the barge's signal rigging, heading inland from the high salt sea. He watched them disappear behind the buildings, then brushed the snow off his coat, shook his hat, and went aboard. It's like holidays.
Holidays?
Yes, holidays. They used to mean the opposite of what they mean now, almost the exact opposite.
What do you mean?
Hey, is this edible?
What?
This.
I don't know, bite it and see.
But it just moved.
It just moved? What, under its own power?
I think so. Well, now, there's a thing. Evolve from a real predator like our friend Zilla, and the instinctive answer's probably yes. But what's this about holidays? Zilla was what he was saying, opposite meaning. Once holidays meant the time when you went away.
Really? Yes, I remember hearing that. Primitive stuff. Age of scarcity.
People had to do all the work and create wealth for themselves and society, and so they couldn't afford to take very much time off. So they worked for, say, half the day, most days of the year, and then had an allocation of days they could take off, having saved up enough exchange collateral, money, technical term, in the meantime. So they took the time off and they went away.
Excuse me, are you edible? Are you really talking to your food?
I don't know. I don't know if it is food.
In very primitive societies, there wasn't even that. They got only a few days off each year.
But I thought primitive societies could be quite primitive industrial, he meant. Take no notice. Will you stop poking that? You'll bruise it.
But can you eat it?
You can eat anything you can get into your mouth and swallow. You know what I mean. Ask, you idiot.
I just did.
Not it. Grief, what are you, glanding? Should you be out? Where's your minder, terminal, whatever?
Well, I didn't want to just... Oh, I see. Did they all go away at once?
How could they? Things would stop working if they all did nothing at the same time.
Oh, of course.
But sometimes they had days when a sort of skeleton crew operated infrastructure. Otherwise, they staggered their time off. Varies from place to place and time to time, as you might expect.
Aha.
Whereas nowadays, what we call holidays, or core time, is when you all stay home. Because otherwise there'd be no period when you could all meet up. You wouldn't know who your neighbours were. Actually, I'm not sure that I do, because we're just so flighty.
One big holiday, in the old sense, and hedonistic.
Itchy feet.
Itchy feet, itchy paws, itchy flippers, itchy barbells.
Hob, can I eat this?
Itchy gas sacks, itchy ribs, itchy wings, itchy pads.
Okay, I think we get the idea. Hob, hello?
Itchy grippers, itchy slime cusps, itchy motile envelopes.
Will you shut up?
Hob, come in. Hob, oh, shit, my terminal's not working.
Or Hub's not answering. Maybe it's on holiday.
Itchy swim bladders, itchy muscle frills, itchy...
Mm!
What? Was there something stuck in my teeth?
Yes, your foot.
I think that's where we kicked off.
Appropriate.
Hub? Hub! Wow, this has never happened to me before.
Arishluia.
Mm-hmm.
His name had been spoken. Kabe discovered that he must have gone into one of those strange, trance-like states he sometimes experienced at gatherings like this. When the conversation, or rather when several conversations at once, went zinging to and fro in a dizzying, alienly human sort of way, and seemed to wash over him, so that he found it difficult to follow who was saying what to whom and why. He'd found that later he could often remember exactly the words that had been said, but he still had to work to determine the sense behind them. At the time, he would just feel oddly detached, until the spell was broken, as now, and he was awakened by his name. He was in the upper ballroom of the ceremonial barge Soliton with a few hundred other people, most of them human, though not all in human form. The recital by the composer Zilla on an antique Chelgrian mosaiki had finished half an hour earlier. It had been a restrained, solemn piece in keeping with the mood of the evening, though its performance had still been greeted with rapturous applause. Now people were eating and drinking, and talking. He was standing with a group of men and women centered on one of the buffet tables. The air was warm, pleasantly perfumed, and filled with soft music. A wood and glass canopy arced overhead, hung with some ancient form of lighting that was a long way from anybody's full spectrum, but which made everything and everybody look agreeably warm. His nose ring had spoken to him. When he had first arrived in the culture, he hadn't liked the idea of having comm equipment inserted into his skull, or anywhere else for that matter. His family nose ring was about the only thing he always carried with him, so they had made him a perfect replica that happened to be a communications terminal as well. "Sorry to disturb you, Ambassador. Hub here, your closest. Would you let Mr. Olsule know he is speaking to an ordinary brooch, not his terminal?"
"Yes."
Kabe turned to a young man in a white suit who was holding a piece of jewellery in his hand and looking puzzled.
Mr. Olsule?
"Yeah, I heard,"
the man said, stepping back to look up at the Hommamdan. He appeared surprised, and Kabe formed the impression that he had been mistaken for a sculpture or an article of monumental furniture. This happened fairly often. A function of scale and stillness, basically. It was one hazard of being a glisteningly black, 3-and-a-bit-meter-tall pyramidal triped in a society of slim, matte-skinned, 2-meter-tall bipeds. The young man squinted at the brooch again.
"I could have sworn this..."
"Sorry about that, Ambassador," said the nose ring. "Thank you for your help."
"Oh, you're welcome."
A gleaming, empty serving tray floated up to the young man, dipped its front in a sort of bow, and said, "Hi, Hub again. What you have there, Mr. Olsule, is a piece of jet in the shape of a cerevel, explosively inlaid with platinum and cemitium, from the studio of Miss Zosin Nabard of Cintrier after the Carafid School. A finely wrought work of substantial artistry, but unfortunately not a terminal.
Damn! Where is my terminal, then?
You left all your terminal devices at home.
Why didn't you tell me?
You asked me not to.
When?
100 and...
Oh, never mind. Well, replace that, change that instruction. Next time I leave home without a terminal, get them to make a fuss or something.
Very well. It will be done. Mr. Olsule scratched his head.
Maybe I should get a lace, one of those implant things.
Undeniably, forgetting your head would pose considerable difficulties. In the meantime, I'll second one of the barge's remotes to accompany you for the rest of the evening, if you'd like.
Yeah, okay.
The young man put the brooch back on and turned to the laden buffet table.
Oh, so anyway, can I eat this...
Oh, it's gone. Itchy, motile envelope, said the tray quietly, floating off.
Eh? Ah, Kabe, my dear friend, here you are. Thank you so much for coming.
Kabe swiveled to find the drone E.H. Tersono floating at his side, at a level a little above head height for a human and a little below that of an homomdam. The machine was a little less than a meter in height and half that in width and depth. Its rounded-off rectangular casing was made of delicate pink porcelain, held in a lattice of gently glowing blue lumenstone. Beyond the porcelain's translucent surface, the drone's internal components could just be made out, shadows beneath its thin ceramic skin. Its aura field, confined to a small volume directly underneath its flat base, was a soft blush of magenta, which, if Kabe recalled correctly, meant it was busy. Busy talking to him?
Tersono, he said. Yes, well, you did invite me.
Indeed I did. Do you know, it occurred to me only later that you might misinterpret my invitation as some sort of summons, even as an imperious demand. Of course, once these things are sent.
Oh, you mean it wasn't a demand?
More of a petition. You see, I have a favor to ask you.
You do?
This was a first.
Yes, I wondered if we might talk somewhere we'd have a little more privacy.
Privacy, thought Kabe. That was a word you didn't hear very often in the culture. Probably more used in a sexual context than any other, and not always, even then.
Of course, he said. Lead on.
Thank you,
the drone said, floating towards the stern and rising to look over the heads of the people gathered in the function space. The machine turned this way and that, making it clear it was looking for something or someone.
Actually, it said quietly, we are not yet quite quarried. Ah, here we are. Please, this way, Arishluya.
They approached a group of humans centered on the Marai Zilla. The Cheldrian was nearly as long as Kabe was tall, and covered in fur that varied from white around his face to dark brown on his back. He had a predator's build, with large forward-facing eyes set in a big, broad-jawed head. His rear legs were long and powerful. A striped tail, woven about with silver chain, curved between them. Where his distant ancestors would have had two middle legs, Zilla had a single broad midlimb, partially covered by a dark waistcoat. His arms were much like a human's, though covered in golden fur and ending in broad, six-digit hands, more like paws. Almost as soon as he and Tersono joined the group around Zilla, Kabe found himself engulfed by another confusing babble of conversation.
Of course you don't know what I mean. You have no context.
preposterous. Everybody has a context. No, you have a situation, an environment, that is not the same thing. You exist. I would hardly deny you that. Well, thanks. Yeah, otherwise you'd be talking to yourself. You're saying we don't really live, is that it? That depends what you mean by live, but let's say yes. How fascinating, my dear Zilla, E.H. Tersono said. I wonder, because we don't suffer?
Because you scarcely seem capable of suffering.
Well said. Now, Zilla, oh, this is such an ancient argument.
But it's only the ability to suffer that...
Hey, I've suffered.
Lemuel Kemp broke my heart. Shut up, Tuli. You know, that makes you sentient or whatever. It's not actually suffering.
But she did.
An ancient argument, you said, Miss Sippins?
Yes.
Ancient meaning bad?
Ancient meaning discredited.
Discredited. By whom?
Not whom, what?
And that what would be...
statistics. So, there we are, statistics. Now then, Zilla, my dear friend...
You are not serious.
I think she thinks she is more serious than you, Zill.
Suffering demeans more than it ennobles.
And this is a statement derived wholly from these statistics.
No, I think you'll find a moral intelligence is required as well. A prerequisite in polite society, I'm sure we'd all agree. Now, Zilla,
a moral intelligence which instructs us that all suffering is bad?
No, a moral intelligence which will incline to treat suffering as bad until proved good.
Ah! So you admit that suffering can be good?
Exceptionally.
Ha!
Oh, nice.
What?
Did you know that works in several different languages?
What?
What does?
Tersono, Zilla said, turning at last to the drone, which had lowered itself to his shoulder level and edged closer and closer, as it had tried to attract the Chelgrian's attention over the past few moments, during which time its aura field had just started to shade into the blue-grey of politely held in check frustration.
Marai Zilla... Composer, half-outcast, half-exile, rose from his crouch and balanced on his rear haunches. His mid-limb made a shelf, briefly, and he put his drink down on the smoothly furred surface, while he used his forelimbs to straighten his waistcoat and comb his brows.
"Help me," he said to the drone. "I am trying to make a serious point, and your compatriot indulges in wordplay."
"Then I suggest you fall back and regroup, and hope to catch her again later when she is in a less trenchantly flippant mood. You've met Arkabe Ishlo, yeah?"
"I have. We are old acquaintances, Ambassador."
"You dignify me, sir," the Homomdan rumbled. "I am more of a journalist."
"Yes, they do tend to call us all ambassadors, don't they? I'm sure it's meant to be flattering."
"No doubt. They mean well."
"They mean ambiguously sometimes," Zilla said, turning briefly to the woman he had been talking to. She raised her glass and bowed her head a fraction.
"When you two have entirely finished criticizing your determinedly generous hosts," Tersono said.
"This would be the private word you mentioned, would it?" Zilla asked.
"Precisely. Indulge an eccentric drone."
"Eh, well.
This way."
The drone continued past the line of food tables towards the stern of the barge. Zilla followed the machine, seeming to flow along the polished deck, lithely graceful on his single broad mid-limb and two strong rear legs. The composer still had his crystal full of wine balanced effortlessly in one hand, Kabe noticed. Zilla used his other hand to wave at a couple of people, who nodded to or greeted him as they passed. Kabe felt very heavy and lumbering in comparison. He tried drawing himself up to his full height, so as to appear less stockily massive, but nearly collided with a very old and complicated light fitting hanging from the ceiling.
This ends side one of cassette one.